Welcome to the Penn Faulkner Podcast. I'm Nate Brown, Deputy Director of the Penn Faulkner Foundation, and in episode 12 of the podcast, we bring you the 2012 Penn Malamud Awards Ceremony and Memorial Reading, which took place at the Folger Elizabethan Theater in Washington, D.C. on December 7th. Established by Bernard Malamud's family to honor excellence in the art of the short story, the prize has been given annually since 1988, and this year honored author James Salter. Among Salter's many works of fiction and nonfiction are two remarkable story collections, Dusk and Last Night. The latter collection leads with the story Comet, which Salter read to a packed house at the ceremony, and you'll hear in this podcast. Among his other works, Salter is the author of the novels The Hunters, A Sport and a Pastime, Light Years, and Solo Faces. His new novel, All That Is, will be published by Knopf in April of 2013. This episode also includes introductory remarks by Penn Faulkner's executive director, Emma Snyder, as well as author, literary critic, and longtime Penn Faulkner board member, Alan Schuss. After the reading, you'll hear Jana Malamud Smith, author and daughter of Bernard Malamud, who presents the award on behalf of the Malamud family and the Penn Faulkner Foundation each year. Thanks as ever to the Folger Shakespeare Library and to Amazon.com, who make this podcast possible, and to Benedict Cupstis for providing the music used in this episode.
And welcome to the Penn Faulkner Reading Series on one of our favorite evenings of the year, the Penn Malamud Awards Ceremony. My name is Emma Snyder, and it is my pleasure to welcome you this evening on behalf of the Foundation and on behalf of the Penn Malamud Award Committee and the Malamud family. This award and this memorial reading were established by Bernard Malamud's family to honor excellence in the art of the short story. Penn Faulkner is and has long been honored to administer the Penn Malamud Award, in memory of both Bernard Malamud and on behalf of the family. And it is therefore fitting to begin this evening with our thanks to the Malamuds themselves, namely Paul Malamud, David Smith, and Jana Malamud Smith. Jana will actually be seen later this evening presenting the award. Thanks as well to the Folger Shakespeare Library, which provides us with this extraordinary stage to call our home. And also thank you to Politics and Prose, that beloved DC institution, which has long been our bookselling partner and who will be selling books at the reception following this evening's reading. Finally, in terms of a logistical thing, if everyone could check their cell phones quickly, just to make sure they're off, so we don't have any interruptions tonight. And then, of course, it is my distinct pleasure to both welcome and thank our recipient of this year's, the 2012 Penn Malamud Award for the short story. James Salter, who is here tonight, I thank not only for traveling here, for his presence and reading this evening, but simply for his body of work. As many of you have experienced, I vividly remember the moment I first encountered a James Salter sentence. For me, I was 17 at the time, and I was on the threshold of literature and trying to figure out what writing was. And I can honestly say it transformed my understanding of language, of scene, of memory. And he seems to me such an appropriate winner for an award that honors Bernard Malamud's vision of the short story, which he described as indicating, as capable of indicating, the complexity of life in just a few pages. But before James takes the stage this evening, it is my pleasure to introduce to you Alan Schuss, who is an excellent short story writer in his own right, a gifted novelist whose most recent novel was Songs of Slaves in the Desert, and who is a first-rate reader of fiction, thinker about, appreciator, and critic. He is someone who many of us have come to listen to and depend on for our own understanding of and distillation of contemporary literature through his reviews on NPR. And he's a longtime member of the Penn Faulkner Board of Directors, a devoted advocate and committee member for the Penn Malamud Award itself, and someone who knows a great deal about the kind of complexity that can come to life in just a few short pages. Alan Schuss.
Good evening, and thank you for coming to what is always a wonderful event. I think of Anne and Byrne on their first date, as they once described it to me. No one could have imagined such wonders could have come from that. Thank you, Jana. Thank you, David. Thank you, Paul. James Salter has published 5 novels, The Hunters, The Arm of Flesh, A Sport and a Pastime, Light Years, Casada, Solo Faces, and there's a new long-awaited novel, All That Is, that's coming out this spring. The world of his novels reflects a broad horizon of war and peace, the intimate and the public life of late 20th century America. In his short stories, he creates a powerful, concentrated form of this same calculus, the life of love, the love of life that we find in the novels. Over the years, his contemporaries and new generations of writers have come to respect and admire and praise and disseminate his short fiction with an intensity found in the appreciation of only our very best. A number of his stories have appeared in O. Henry collections and in the Best American Short Stories. His collection, Dusk and Other Stories, 1988, received the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction in 1989, and tonight we're here to celebrate him as the 2012 winner of the Malamud Award for Excellence in the Short Story. Salter's short stories offer us, among other delights and other darker insights, a magnifying glass for viewing the elemental triumph of his art, which is, as Emma suggested, his sentence making. No iron can stab the heart with such force as a period put just at the right place, says the narrator of Isaac Babel's short story, Guy de Maupassant. In a nation made up out of sentences, from Thomas Jefferson's in the founding documents out of which we all have sprung, to Emerson's dramatic aphorisms about our American character and soul, on through the fundamental declarations about the nature of American prose made by Gertrude Stein and her good student Ernest Hemingway, and Faulkner's rhetorical entwinings, which Bennett Cerf once in a review described the run-on pages of sentences as, in Faulkner, as the life sentence. In all of these, we find the masters of our language punctuating their accomplishments in prose, whether in essays or novels or beautifully made wonders of short fiction, all of this in the service of staying alive in our hearts and souls. There comes a time when you realize that everything is a dream, our honoree says in an epigram to his forthcoming novel, All That Is. There comes a time when you realize that everything is a dream, and only those things preserved in writing have any possibility of being real. It's my pleasure to introduce to you tonight dreamer and realist James Salter.
Thank you. 1988, I was here before, and there was a party given the night before, and at the party, a woman came up to me and said, "Are you James Salter?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "My father's a better writer than you are." Isaac Singer was one of the nominees that year. And I thought, I was about to agree with her, but she wasn't talking about Isaac Singer. Anyway, one of the nice things about this evening is there are no other writers. I am the writer this evening. This is a story called Comet. Philip married Adele on a day in June. It was cloudy and the wind was blowing. Later the sun came out. It had been a while since Adele had married, and she wore white. White pumps with low heels, a long white skirt that clung to her hips, a filmy blouse with a white bra underneath, and around her neck a string of freshwater pearls. They were married in her house, the one she'd gotten in the divorce. All her friends were there. She believed strongly in friendship. The room was crowded. "I, Adele," she said in a clear voice, "give myself to you, Phil, completely as your wife." Behind her, as best man, somewhat oblivious, her young son was standing, and pinned to her panties, as something borrowed, was a small silver disc, actually a St. Christopher's medal her father had worn in the war. She had several times rolled down the waistband of her skirt to show it to people. Near the door, under the impression that she was part of a garden tour, was an old woman who had a little dog held by the handle of a cane hooked through his neck. At the reception, Adele smiled with happiness, drank too much, laughed, and scratched her bare arms with long showgirl nails. Her new husband admired her. He could have licked her palms like a calf does salt. She was still young enough to be good looking, the final blaze of it, though she was too old for children, at least if she had anything to say about it. Summer was coming. Out of the afternoon haze, she would appear in her black bathing suit, limbs all tan, the brilliant sun behind her. She was a strong figure walking up the smooth sand from the sea, her legs, her wet swimmer's hair, the grace of her, all careless and unhurried. They settled into life together, hers mostly. It was her furniture and her books, though they were largely unread. She liked to tell stories about Delirio, her first husband, Frank, his name was, the heir to a garbage hauling empire. She called him Delirium, but the stories were not unaffectionate. Loyalty. It came from her childhood as well as the years of marriage. 8 exhausting years, as she said. Loyalty was her code. The terms of marriage had been simple, she admitted. Her job was to be dressed, have dinner ready, and be fucked once a day. One time in Florida with another couple, they chartered a boat to go bone fishing off Bimini. "Well, have a good dinner," Delirio had said happily. "Get on board and turn in. When we get up, we'll have passed the Gulf Stream." It began that way, but ended differently. The sea was very rough. They never did cross the Gulf Stream. The captain was from Long Island and got lost. Delirio paid him $50 to turn over the wheel and go below. "Do you know anything about boats?" the captain asked. "More than you do," Delirio told him. He was under an ultimatum from Adele, who was lying deathly pale in their cabin. "Get us into port somewhere or get ready to sleep by yourself," she said. Philip Ardette had heard the story and many others often. He was mannerly and elegant. His head held back a bit as he talked, as though you were a menu. He and Adele had met on the golf course when she was learning to play. It was a wet day, and the course was nearly empty. Adele and a friend were teeing off when a balding figure carrying a cloth bag with a few clubs in it asked if he could join them. Adele hit a passable drive. Her friend bounced his across the road, teed up another, which he topped. Phil, rather shyly, took out an old three wood and hit one 200 yards straight down the fairway. That was his persona, capable and calm. He'd gone to Princeton and been in the Navy. He looked like someone who'd been in the Navy, Adele said. His legs were strong. The first time she went out with him, he remarked, "It was a funny thing. Some people liked him, some didn't. The ones that do, I tend to lose interest in," he said. She wasn't sure just what that meant, but she liked his appearance, which was a bit worn, especially around the eyes. It made her feel he was a real man, though perhaps not the man he had been. Also, he was smart, as she explained it, more or less the way professors were. To be liked by her was worthwhile, but to be liked by him seemed somehow of even greater value. There was something about him that discounted the world. He appeared in a way to care nothing for himself, to be above that. He didn't make much money, as it turned out. He wrote for a business weekly. She earned nearly that much selling houses. She had begun to put on a little weight. This was a few years after they were married. She was still beautiful, her face was, but she had adopted a more comfortable outline. She would get into bed with a drink, the way she had done when she was 25. Phil, a sport jacket over his pajamas, sat reading. Sometimes he walked that way on their lawn in the morning. She sipped her drink and watched him. You know something? What? I've had good sex since I was 15, she said. He looked up. I didn't start quite that young, he confessed. Maybe you should have. Yeah, good advice, a little late though. Do you remember when we first got started? I remember. We could hardly stop, she said. You remember? It averages out. Oh, great, she said. After he'd gone to sleep, she watched a movie. The stars grew old, too, and had problems with love. It was different, though. They had already reaped huge rewards. She watched, thinking. She thought of what she had been, what she had had. She could have been a star. What did Phil know? He was sleeping. Autumn came. One evening they were at the Morrisseys. Morrissey was a tall lawyer, the executor of many estates, and trustee of others. Reading wills had been his true education, a look into the human heart, he said. At the dinner was a man from Chicago who'd made a fortune in computers, a nitwit, it soon became apparent, who during the meal gave a toast. To the end of privacy and the life of dignity, he said. He was with a dampened woman who had recently found out that her husband had been having an affair with a black woman in Cleveland, an affair that had somehow been going on for 7 years. There may have even been a child. You can see why coming here is like a breath of fresh air for me, she said. The women were sympathetic. They knew what she had to do. She had to rethink completely the past 7 years. That's right, her companion agreed. What is there to be rethought, Phil wanted to know. He was answered with impatience. The deception, they said, the deception. She had been deceived all that time. Adele, meanwhile, was pouring more wine for herself. Her napkin covered the place where she'd already spilled a glass of it. But that time was spent in happiness, wasn't it, Phil asked guilelessly. That's been lived, can't be changed. It can't be just turned into unhappiness. That woman stole my husband. She stole everything he had vowed. Well, forgive me, Phil said softly. That happens every day. There was an outcry as if from a chorus, heads thrust forward like the hissing sacred geese. Only Adele sat silent. Every day, he repeated, his voice drowned out, the voice of reason, or at least of fact. I never steal anyone's man, Adele said then. Never. Her face had a tone of weariness when she drank, a weariness that knew the answer to everything. And I'd never break a vow. I don't think you would, Phil said. I'd never fall for a 20-year-old either. She was talking about the tutor, the girl who had come that time, youth burning through her clothes. No, you wouldn't. He left his wife, Adele told them. There was silence. Phil's bit of smile had gone, but his face was still pleasant. I didn't leave my wife, he said quietly. She threw me out. He left his wife and children, Adele said. I didn't leave them. Anyway, it was over between us. It had been for more than a year. He said it evenly, almost as if it had happened to someone else. It was my son's tutor, he explained. I fell in love with her. And you began something with her, Morrissey suggested. Oh, yes. There's love when you lose the power to speak, when you cannot even breathe. Within 2 or 3 days, he confessed. There in the house? Phil shook his head. He had a strange, helpless feeling. He was abandoning himself. I didn't do anything in the house. He left his wife and children, Adele repeated. You knew that, Phil said. Just walked out on them. They'd been married 15 years since he was 19. We hadn't been married 15 years. They had 3 children, she said, one of them retarded. Something had happened. He was becoming speechless. He could feel it in his chest, like a kind of nausea, as if he were giving up portions of an intimate past. He wasn't retarded, he managed to say. He was having trouble learning to read, that's all. At that instant, an aching image of himself and his son from years before came to him. They had rowed one afternoon to the middle of a friend's pond and jumped in, just the two of them. It was summer. His son was 6 or 7. There was a layer of warm water over deeper, cooler water, the faded green of frogs and weeds. They swam to the far side and then all the way back. The blonde head and anxious face of his boy above the surface like a dog's. Year of joy. So tell them the rest of it, Adele said. There is no rest. It turned out this tutor was some kind of call girl. He found her in bed with some guy. Is that right, Morrissey said. He was leaning on a table, his chin in his hand. You think you know someone. You think because you have dinner with them or play cards, but you really don't. It's always a surprise. You know nothing. It didn't matter, Phil murmured. So stupid marries her anyway, Adele went on. She comes to Mexico City where he's working and he marries her. You don't understand anything, Adele, he said. He wanted to say more, but couldn't. It was like being out of breath. You still talk to her, Morrissey asked casually. Yes, over my dead body, Adele said. None of them could know. None of them could visualize Mexico City and the first unbelievable year, driving down to the coast for the weekend, through Cuernavaca, her bare legs with the sun lying on them, her arms, the dizziness and submission he felt with her, as before a forbidden photograph, as if before an overwhelming work of art. 2 years in Mexico City, oblivious to the wreckage. It was a sense of godliness that empowered him. He could see her neck bent forward with its slender nape. He could see the faint trace of bones like pearls that ran down her smooth back. he could see himself, his former self. "I talked to her," he admitted. "And your first wife?" "I talked to her. We have 3 kids." "He left her," Adele said. "Casanova here." "Some women have minds like cops," Phil said to no one in particular. "This is right, that's wrong. Well, anyway," he stood up. He had done everything wrong, he realized, in the wrong order. He had scuttled his life. "Anyway, there's one thing I can say truthfully. I'd do it all over again if I had the chance." After he had gone, they went on talking. The woman whose husband had been unfaithful for 7 years knew what it was like. "He pretends he can't help it," she said. "I've had the same thing happen. I was going by Bergdorf's one day and saw a green coat in the window that I liked, and I went in and bought it. Then a little while later, someplace else, I saw one that was better than the first one, I thought, so I bought that. Anyway, by the time I was finished, I had 4 green coats hanging in the closet. It was just because I couldn't control my desires." Outside, the sky, the topmost dome of it, was brushed with clouds, and the stars were dim. Adele finally made him out, standing far off in the darkness. She walked unsteadily toward him. His head, she saw, was raised. She stopped a few yards away and raised her head too, and the sky began to whirl. She took an unexpected step or two to steady herself. "What are you looking at?" she finally said. He didn't answer. He had no intention of answering. "The comet," he said. "It's been in the papers. This is the night it's supposed to be most visible." There was silence. "I don't see any comet," she said. "You don't? Where is it?" "It's right up there," he gestured. "Doesn't look like anything, just like another small star. It's that extra one by the Pleiades." He knew all the constellations. He had seen them rise in darkness over heartbreaking coasts. "Come on, you can look at it tomorrow," she said almost consolingly, though she came no closer to him. "Won't be there tomorrow. One time only." "How do you know where it'll be?" she said. "Come on, it's late. Let's get out of here." He didn't move. After a bit, she walked toward the house, where extravagantly every window, upstairs and down, was lit. He remained where he was, looking up at the sky, and then at her, as she became smaller and smaller, going across the lawn, reaching first the aura, then the brightness, and then tripping on the kitchen steps. That's the end. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
First of all, I just want to thank you for coming. And I want to thank the Penn Faulkner Committee and Emma Snyder for all her hard work. And especially I want to thank the Penn Malamud Committee and its chair, Deborah Tannen, who can't be here tonight, but whose generous effort has continued to sustain this award. It's been 28 years since my father died, so let me recall him by telling you a bit about how he worked. He wrote his manuscripts by hand, with the first draft slowly growing a word or a sentence at a time on the single sheets of yellow newsprint. I don't know why he picked yellow, except perhaps that the reams were less expensive than the bond he used for final drafts. He often wrote with Bic pens, though he owned some nicer ballpoints. And when I was a young child, he used a fountain pen. He could type, and sometimes he did, on a black Royal typewriter. But my mother also typed for him, especially later or final drafts on her Hermes portable. She had to use carbon paper to produce a second and third copy, and when she missed a stroke, she had to erase all the layers. She could grow irritated, especially if she felt pressured and made too many errors. She was not a passive scribe, but one with opinions, which could be strong. Her views were sometimes appreciated by my father, sometimes not so much. We moved to Vermont from Oregon in 1961, and less than a decade after my father's success with his novel, The Fixer, allowed him to cut his teaching to part-time. Still, he was up by 7, and he wrote at least 5 mornings a week. Sometimes, pushed by his doctor and his bad heart, he walked a bit in the early a.m. before breakfast. And he took a longer walk around 4 most afternoons. Then he took a nap so he'd be alert to read in the evenings. My parents had a large circle of friends, and my mother cooked delicious, unpretentious meals. But my father's rule was that they could not have more than 3 or 4 at the most evenings engagements a week, or else he wouldn't have enough time to read. He would be seated at his desk by around 8:30 or 8:45. I don't quite remember anymore, but I guarantee you could set your clock by his daily habits. He wrote until his lunch at 1. My parents had a complicated understanding, a kind of Treaty of Versailles, about when my mother could interrupt him, when not. Definitely if an editor or agent called with good news. Definitely not for most other callers or circumstances, though a household crisis would provide reason. I felt comfortable disturbing him one time a morning when I was home. Once in a while, if I walked past his door, he would call me in to listen to a sentence he'd written, or to get my opinion on a word, or just to ask how I planned to pass my day. I don't think he allowed himself much distraction at his desk, but who knows? His study was book-lined with floor-to-ceiling shelves on 2 sides. He had a classic old Vermont maple wood rocking chair with a cane seat that he sometimes sat in to read in the afternoon after he had finished answering letters. My mother hunted down used furniture and refinished it, and the rocker was one acquisition that pleased them both. It eased his back. His work habits bring to mind Monty Python's skit in which a sports commentator watches Thomas Hardy write and becomes breathless over whether he will produce an A or a the. Nothing could be duller to observe, and of course, that's the wonder. Throughout the mornings, my father labored silently with great discipline, day in, day out. He'd begin by rereading the half page he'd written the day before and crossing out words that no longer fit his purpose. Gradually, warming up to the effort, he'd start to write one sentence, then the next, across weeks and months, producing first one draft of a story, then another, and another, and another, sometimes into the double digits. He taught me and all the other close witnesses that writing was a craft that required great effort, great patience, and great dedication. My mother would have liked to travel more, but he found his deepest satisfaction at his desk. It is in honor of that labor of writing, however practiced, and in honor of the gorgeous, carefully crafted stories that result, like the one we heard tonight, that it gives me great pleasure tonight to give the Penn Malamud Award for Excellence in Short Fiction to James Salter.
Penn Faulkner Foundation supports the art of writing and encourages readers of all ages. To sustain and build our programs, we rely on the generosity of individuals, foundations, corporations, and government agencies. You can help Penn Faulkner fulfill its mission of encouraging a love of reading by visiting pennfaulkner.org/support.